Wouldn't you love to get paid for doing what you love to do? If you're ready to move on to what's next, join us for Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson. Our uplifting live talk show on Saturday mornings from 10 to noon will have you circling back, not running in circles, to pull your experience forward in new ways. Advance your career, plus help others with theirs. Join us Saturdays, 10 to noon, right here on 104.1 The Truth, for pragmatic advice and unconventional wisdom. Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson, where your path is created by walking on it. Passports ready. We're going to be with a colleague of mine here in the studio, Peggy Bendel of Peggy Bendel Communications International. Welcome to the studio.
It's a pleasure, Zara.
Yes, well, and indeed, let me give this introduction. Peggy is a globally recognized expert in travel and tourism, marketing, branding, public relations, and interestingly enough, crisis communications. She's a principal in the seminal I Love New York campaign, and Peggy has worked also with more than 50 U.S. and international destinations, from Australia to the U.S. Virgin Islands, South Africa to Sweden, and more than a dozen hospitality industry clients, including hotels, resorts, tour operations, and associations. She's a frequent speaker at conferences and writer for publications, and last year she published the book It's a Crisis, Now What?, the first step-by-step crisis communication handbook for the global tourism and hospitality industry. Peggy also is a media and presentation coach, so you're going to see a real natural with me here on the radio. Active in several trade industry associations, Peggy received a Lifetime Achievement Public Relations Award from the Hospitality Sales and Marketing Association International, and her work has received many gold, silver, and bronze awards over the years. A graduate of Georgian Court University, Peggy also studied public administration at NYU, and today she and her husband live between Tucson and New York. So I'm glad we caught you on a weekend you were in town.
Me too.
So tell me, how many stamps do you have in that passport?
I've never counted them. And the disappointment today is that so many places don't stamp them.
Exactly.
Because
anymore.
When you go to Europe, there's no border crossing. Anymore. But I have a few, and I've kept all of the passports that I've ever had. And you were right. I do have extra pages in the last two.
In the last two.
The current one.
Well, your background, having come out of Georgian Court University, were you on this trajectory to drive, to pick the travel industry? Were you a longtime voyager, rather through reading or as a child?
Not at all, but when I look back, I think there are two things that influenced my interest in it. One of them was growing up in New Jersey, where it was recreation on Sunday afternoon to drive to Newark Airport, which then had a very open observation deck, and watch the planes landing and taking off. No, and actually, your phrase, where your path is created by walking on it, really resonated with me, because that's exactly what happened. I had internships and summer jobs in the healthcare industry. My dad was a volunteer with the rescue squad, the local rescue squad, mm-hmm. and I'd always been very interested in healthcare, and so I took an exam for New York State. My mom was a longtime state employee and found that a good career path, and was very disappointed not to have been hired by the health department. Was called in for an interview in the Albany office of what was then called the New York State Commerce Department, to this subset of office called the Travel Bureau. Couldn't imagine what that was, and was hired by them. And interestingly enough, in this small, perhaps 12-person office, found myself surrounded by people who knew my family, which was from that area. So it was a very warm and wonderful experience. I went to trade shows. I came in on Saturdays and did the ski reports for New York State. And then I was getting married, and I thought, well, that was fun. You know, it's time to find a new path. And the only public relations job in the New York City office of the Commerce Department opened up at that time. And I interviewed for it, was hired to work in it, working in economic development and international trade, and then happened to be in the right place at the right time when the masters of marketing who started the I Love New York campaign were beginning that, what turned out to be I Love New York, and was made a member of that team, the only professional, as it happened, on staff, as that was building, and it was really like getting a marketing MBA on the job.
I was going to say, in fact, I had my T-shirt out I was going to wear in this morning, and I forgot.
I have one of the originals, so one day we'll have to get together.
I'm going to have to find another one on eBay then. No, you're right. No, I've got them probably in all colors.
Well, it's actually one of the most, as I'm sure everyone knows now, the most imitated form logos there is. There is, I actually saw I Heart My Corgi on someone's bumper stickers I was driving in today.
Well, and in fact, my daughter, when we were living back in Connecticut, she always called it UNORC instead of New York.
Ah.
So we always, can we go into UNORC City? So absolutely, we know the affinity and connection with the city.
And of course, it's not a city campaign. Everyone thinks of it as New York City, but it was for the entire state.
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay, you're right. And you're right, we do think it of as, mm-hmm. As a city. So from that to then establishing your own company.
There were a couple of steps in between. The largest one was moving out of state government after many years there into a private public relations firm, Development Counselors International, where I relaunched their tourism program. They are specialists in marketing places and have a very strong client list in economic development and tourism from around the world. And so it was really a seminal experience for me. I joined them, taking some time off from New York State, in a pitch to the Australian Tourist Commission. I don't know if you remember the Put a Shrimp on the Barbie campaign or
that I
did with Paul Hogan in the 80s, but we were hired to do the public relations for that. And in fact, my present husband and I were married on my first trip to Australia, so we have very fond memories of Sydney.
And isn't that interesting, too? I mean, I think the United States being the mecca for public relations, marketing, and technology, most certainly then other countries keeping an eye out and wanting to snatch up the professionals to help them.
And interestingly enough, the Australian Tourist Commission, or Tourism Australia, as it's now known, has really been the lodestar for destination marketing as a whole, and acknowledged that it was very important to have a public relations presence in all of the countries in which they were active, which are many, many more now than it was then. But it was, again, wonderful working with such a wonderful team of professionals.
And the idea that, of course, you've parlayed that then to work in other locations around the world. What countries come to mind that really have been your most favorite ones then?
South Africa always tops the list.
Beautiful, yeah.
We began our work with South Africa in 1993, a year before President Mandela was elected.
I was going to say that was in a really difficult time of apartheid.
But a very exciting time. Apartheid was actually over in 1991, but many people were not aware of that. And so one of the first things we had to do was educate the news media as well as the travel media that sanctions had been lifted by the U.S. government and that apartheid had officially ended. And it was a certain thing that that Nelson Mandela would be elected president. But what was uncertain was what that intervening year was going to be like. And, of course, as we now know, there was certainly some controversy, but relatively little in terms of disturbance.
And a very peaceful transition. Yeah.
Very peaceful transition, and probably the only human being who could have stepped into that role and succeeded at it as he has. And, you know, he's now considerably older, but still regarded as one of the seminal figures in the history of that country and well beyond.
And so your affection for your work there, was it associated again with the tumultuous nature of the political environment at that time, as well as the people you met, or the striking beauty, or the remoteness? And was
all,
it,
of the
all of the above. I kind of thought so.
I'm an animal person, Sarah.
Yes,
my husband
course.
And I have 10 cats at home.
Oh, my.
And
yes.
So one of the first attractions of being able to go to South Africa, which I've been able to do many, many times now, was to see the amazing wildlife that's still there.
One of the advantages of the job.
It is.
Right.
But I must say that, and this was true of all of the media representatives that I brought with me on various occasions, too, people go the first time to see the wildlife, of course. They come back talking about the people.
Yeah.
The warmth of welcome is truly remarkable. And I honestly have never felt as at home as quickly anywhere else in the world as I did in South Africa on my first trip. And I do think, and others have written about this, I do think there's something to the fact that our species originated there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something deep in our psyche, or perhaps in our very bodies, in our cells, that recognize our home there. I've heard many, many people comment on that.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Well, I have in front of me, and thank you very much for bringing it to us, a copy of your book, It's a Crisis, Now What? The Step-by-Step Crisis Communication Handbook for the Global Tourism and Hospitality Industry. I mean, I don't think many people appreciate the fact that public relations within companies or those that hire firms like you've been involved in are as much about dealing about the tough stuff as it is about the brochures of the beauty and attracting people to come. But how is it you came to write your book then?
There are many really good books about crisis communications. Very few of them have examples drawn from the tourism industry.
Specifically, yeah.
the examples that come up again and again are Union Carbide in Bhopal and Johnson & Johnson and the Tylenol crisis. And I have de facto become a bit of an expert because of some of our clients. Certainly South Africa was an ongoing crisis for that first year of work with them. We were working with Hong Kong when the SARS epidemic took place.
I was just going to say, and SARS is one that comes full to force. I have several work colleagues that couldn't come home because of the SARS epidemic in China, and they were there for many, many weeks.
And of course, it did end up coming to Canada, if you recall. There were some early cases in Canada as well. We had a hotel client, which was very unusual for DCI. And one day my phone rang and my client said, "Do you do crisis communications?" And it turned out that at a sister property, another brand that was related to that, there had been a murder-suicide take place in the hotel. You can't control what happens behind a closed door, but it had taken place a week earlier and had been undiscovered until that day.
Wow.
And certainly someone should have been in that hotel room, and it certainly wasn't the chambermaid's fault. So that was really the crisis. The story was so sensational, as you can well imagine, both of the people involved were married to others and had been missing and the whole thing, that the question was never asked of the hotel management. Why didn't somebody go into that room? Why didn't somebody check it? That was the potential crisis for them. So having waited for someone else to write a crisis handbook, because every tourism entity I've come up against knows they need a crisis communications plan. Very few of them have that because I think it's going to be time consuming and complicated to pull together.
And yet it takes just one minor complication to potentially take your entire firm down.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And it doesn't have to happen. So what I did was create not a theoretical book or a book of examples, but a step-by-step, four steps to do your crisis communications plan, and then seven tips for managing a crisis, managing the communications of a crisis when it does occur. Because for almost every destination and many hotel groups, certainly not every hotel or tour operator, it's a matter of when, not of if. You know, if you have a hotel on the beach someplace in Florida, that you're going to have a problem with, you name it, jellyfish, hurricanes, oil spill, be prepared. Know who you have to call. Know who should know about you. Don't be proactive about identifying your key personnel to the local emergency responders.
Right, the whole business readiness plan.
It's pretty simple. It's pretty basic.
But it's so easy to overlook. You know, it's like for people who live in parts of the country that may be subject to earthquakes, and they always say, well, create your earthquake plan and make sure you have somebody remotely you can call and so on, but yet we can get caught off guard. Well, I have to imagine then that most certainly in the last couple of years, the number of crises that have appeared on cruise ships that oh, my word.
Funny you
should
mention
that. Read your book, clearly. We've got a stack we need to mail to them.
Well, I started blogging on the topic at itsacrisisnowwhat.com. And I have to say that I almost feel I owe an apology to Carnival Cruises, and yet they've given me so much material to blog about.
Yeah.
One thing after the other after the other. And, of course, the Costa Concordia, which made international headlines, was a Carnival brand, although they perhaps wisely tried not to be identified with it. But since then, we've had the Triumph, we've had the Legend, we've had the Dream that have had various crises.
And by the way, this just doesn't influence one particular company. It discolors the entire industry. So we're all in this together. Any company that's involved in cruising has got to be sitting there just white-knuckling through whatever their compatriot colleague competitors are going through.
Well, about 10 days ago, Royal Caribbean had a fire, as you may remember. And they handled the situation so well that my blog post about that is titled, "Hey Carnival, Take a Lesson from Royal Caribbean." They instantly accepted responsibility, even though, you know, fires happen. They were prepared for it. They were well-trained. The crew got nothing but praise from the people who were involved. They immediately said, "We're refunding all of your money for this cruise and giving you a discount on a future one. We're arranging airfare." They didn't wait to be asked. They had that, and obviously they had that because they'd had a discussion about it.
They did, and also, like we spoke about in an earlier segment today, at the end of the day, what are the values and ethics that drive your organization? So you can be equipped then when you get on that slippery, icy slope of the unexpected, which every business leader gets involved in.
One of the things that I tell all of my clients, not even in a crisis situation, is that you don't have to wait to call the media these days. We're all the media.
That's true.
If you look at what happened last week in Chicago with the Chicago Sun-Times firing their entire photographic staff because they're now expecting their reporters to use an iPhone to do photos and video, you understand that now the media is becoming us. It's not just us becoming the media. The media is becoming us. And it's a little scary, but it's something you need to be prepared for. We worked with a theme park, and I said to them, you know, you could have a problem at the top of your Ferris wheel, and you wouldn't even know about it until the media appeared. You're the guy who's operating that Ferris wheel won't know, because somebody in an adjacent car has taken a picture of whatever the problem
is.
Put on Twitter. Absolutely.
But then on the positive side, you look at the tremendous rallying and assistance in the recent tragedy in Boston at the marathon, that the crowdsourcing of We Need Help brought to force so much important information to help the FBI. And
that, yes, that was incredibly important. And, of course, that was, in its way, a very fortunate set of circumstances in that they had emergency and medical personnel right there, very near. If you think about the strategy of those, I don't know what word to use except terrorists, it was probably not the best place if you wanted to do major damage.
With regard to
place those bombs.
That's right.
Because you did help that help available.
That's right. Okay, we're speaking with Peggy Bendel, and her organization is Bendel Communications International. The website, BendelCommunications.com, and also her book, It's a Crisis, Now What? And I would say while certainly the cases and the vignettes you mentioned are systemic or important to the travel tourism industry, there's a lot of basic how-tos here for anyone. And by the way, folks, this is not just for large organizations. Solopreneurs need to be available and mindful of these kind of things as well.
Almost more so, because you don't have an in-house crisis communications team.
Right.
You need to be able to build that. You can't fulfill all of those roles and there aren't many. There are three or four key roles in a larger organization. You would want to have backup for each person in those roles, but it's absolutely true, Zara, that it is almost more important for an individual to have a crisis communications
small times. Well, tell me, what do you consider one of your most interesting assignments that you've handled over the years, Peggy?
There have been many of them. I would say dealing with Hong Kong at the time of the SARS epidemic was a very interesting one, because it was not something that the Hong Kong Tourism Board could control.
Mm-hmm, right.
The decision about the end of that crisis could be made only by the World Health Organization and the Center for Disease Control. So we simply had to be ready, as we were. And I was roused out of bed at 6 o'clock one Friday morning with the news that they had officially declared the SARS epidemic over. And I was able to, from my bedside, call the media distribution service and send them electronically the press release that had already been okayed to get that out right away, and then head to the office after a very quick shower and start preparing for the phone calls that were coming in that were basically what happens next.
What
How
now?
Quickly do you think tourism is going to turn around? That sort of thing.
Well, which of course we all know here, you and your husband have chosen to invest and be bi-coastal, I'll say, between New York and here in Tucson. You know, our community is so dependent upon tourism and, the wonderful cornucopia of people that come to enjoy not just the various attractions, but actually take up part-time residency included in that. And we love you that you do that. But also, we also have challenges within our state, whether it be dynamics playing out in the border or heat stroke or other things that can kind of get us in a position of tripping up ourselves. Well, yes, I was going to say, and legislation.
And the truth is that SB 1070, what has been referred to as the anti-immigration law, the severity of which has been superseded by similar laws in other states, but it was really the first, and it hit very hard. I've had the pleasure of doing some work with the Arizona Office of Tourism, and when making media appointments for them, I would say not many, but a couple of reporters actually refused to meet, particularly with Latino publications, because they felt so targeted by that law. And by extension, by the state, I'm putting air quotes around that, even though, of course, as a tourism promotion organization, the Arizona Office of Tourism's position and activity is welcoming to all people who would love to come to Arizona.
That's right, and staying on top of that one. So what would you say some of your most challenging assignments have been then? Ones that, were you surfing in the unknown personally, or are you really playing on your intuition?
I have a wonderful client based in the UK who 20 years ago walked 2,000 miles in the footsteps of Alexander the Great.
Oh, my.
helped produce a BBC documentary about Alexander the Great, and now with fellow archaeologists and historian guides, takes people on tours using the beautiful traditional hand-built wooden Turkish gullets, beautiful sailing ships in Greece, in Turkey, and in Italy. Greece and Turkey, I think you know, have been the site of quite a bit of
economic distress.
As we speak here today, the demonstrations in Istanbul are going into, I believe, their 11th day. His tours don't go near either of those places. They're not tours of Athens. They're not tours of Istanbul. But perception is reality.
Of course.
And so it is important for him to be able to say, as he does very effectively on his website and in interviews, we are concerned about that for the people who are involved in it, but if you come on one of our tours, you won't even be flying into Athens or Istanbul. You'll be going to, to another community. So that has been challenging because the news headlines are so dominant that it's hard to get the tourism message out, but we're working on it.
That's right. Well, and also, of course, you don't want to, spite your nose to spite your face, because that whole situation will turn around eventually.
Oh,
so you
absolutely
don't want to be viewed at all of not still being an advocate of the beauty of Athens and Istanbul.
Have you been to Greece?
Yes, absolutely. I got quite a sunburn for us redheads there. Yes, I have. But you're right. It's an amazingly beautiful country, as well as Turkey. Again, mm-hmm. Gorgeous part of the world. Well, before we run out of time, some advice you might offer to listeners who are interested in either launching, relaunching, trying out the travel and tourism business for their own career.
It's the largest industry in the world, but not perceived as such mm-hmm. because it's very diffuse. It's not like looking at a steel plant down the street. It's hotels. It's a piece of rental cars, but not all of it.
Okay, that's true.
It's a piece of restaurants, but not all of it. But it has been, and a report just came out from the U.S. Department of Commerce the other day, noting that without the favorable balance of trade that inbound tourism, international visitors coming to the United States, provides, our trade deficit would be 10.6% larger. So that and job creation in the travel and tourism industry has been 15% higher than in the rest of the country as a whole. And so it's a very important industry that has jobs available that people don't normally think of. There are now, as there weren't when I went to school, programs even on the high school level in travel and tourism that can help shape a career.
Absolutely.
And it's been a wonderful one.
Yeah, well, great for you. And I love the fact that, your tagline would be accidental traveler because I couldn't get into healthcare, right? But you've got such a smile on your face that it's clearly the right place for you and has been and will continue to be. Great. I want to commend as well, Kat, to our guest, Peggy Bendall, and her book, It's a Crisis, Now What? And it's a book really that others of us, not just in travel and tourism, would benefit from.
And it's available on Amazon.
Very good. Thanks for joining me today, Peggy.
Change is chaotic. That is, unless you embrace it, going places you hadn't dreamed were possible. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, is a leadership consulting, executive coaching, and career transition firm. We help individuals make the most of their current employment situation or to step forward confidently into a career transition. Contact us at thelarsongroup.com or toll free 1-877-544-2580. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, helping others unleash potential through transformational change. 1-877-544-2580.